Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there. Almost 3,000 now. Better than 150 of them are with our next guest, Gareth Porter, the best reporter for Interpress Service, ipsnews.net, and author of Perils of Dominance. Can be a tricky business, dominance. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Gareth?
I'm doing fine. Thanks very much, Scott. Glad to be back.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. So listen, the reports are in that the North Vietnamese communists have attacked our patrol boats. I mean, Saddam Hussein did the anthrax attacks. I mean, Bashar al-Assad, why, he's using sarin gas against his people.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what they said on CNN.
I've heard the rumor, yeah. So are you asking me a question about that?
Yeah, well, are you buying it or not?
Not yet. I've seen the videos, and I'm not quite sure what to make of them. But at this point, it's hardly proof that this happened. And I must tell you that the one thing that my thoughts keep coming back to this point that really bothers me that there is no, as far as I know, there's been no video posted on the internet so far showing what was actually happening during the alleged chemical attack. That would, of course, be far more persuasive, far more important in terms of visual evidence of a chemical attack, to see the immediate effect on people of the alleged chemicals that were being dropped or being fired at the site. So, I mean, I find that, at least so far, to be an anomaly that I'm going to be watching.
Okay, now, is it two or three times in the past there have been reported chemical attacks like these against the so-called rebels there, whatever you want to call them, the fighters?
I don't know if it's been two or three times, but maybe three times, yeah, that there have been claims of this.
And the Obama administration has ended up, the State Department has ended up saying, actually, you know, we're not certain that the evidence is strong enough to really make a compelling case. And this kind of, they've weaseled out of it, thank goodness,
yeah,
so far, right?
I think that's pretty much the case. They've tried to kind of have it both ways, that, you know, they've allowed the impression to linger that that these reports are credible, but they have not completely embraced them, I think is fair to say.
Hmm. Well, let's hope that keeps up.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as you know, and people who follow the news carefully would know, the previous reports were not very precise, and certainly did not have the kind of visual evidence that they're now trying to suggest is convincing to prove that there was a major chemical attack, and in fact, you know, that's the major reason why the evidence in the previous instances has not been given a whole lot of credibility.
Mm. Well, now, the Obama spokesman just said the other day, I guess it was the State Department spokesman, not Carney, but I think it was the State Department guy, said, oh, yeah, no, our policy is still that Assad must go.
Yeah.
And that is the only option that we will settle for, et cetera. And yet, then you have Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying, I don't want to arm up these guys, and I don't want to start even a single bombing, because if I do, then that means that I need to bring my entire army with me, or else I'm not going.
Yeah, and this is, I think, the biggest and best indication so far that I was correct, that the U.S. military wants no part of any war in Syria, just as it wants no part in any war against Iran. I think the military and the Pentagon have made up their mind that we should definitely stay out of that one. And there's no doubt that that is exercising a healthy degree of restraint on those within the administration who would be much more enthusiastic about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yet the red line stands, or does it, I guess?
Well, I don't think it. I don't think that red line is very meaningful at this point. In fact, if I understand the rhetoric in the not about the present situation, but about the previous instances that we've been talking about, the administration, the Obama administration, did not, really take a very clear-cut position about whether its red line had been exceeded or not. And I think that red line is not a terribly meaningful guide to policy at this point. I don't think that it's I don't think they intend to use that as a basis for intervening, and I don't think they will. I don't think that the United States is going to do what the Saudis, Prince Bandar, and the Saudis and the Qataris want us to do,
which is full-scale regime change in Damascus.
Well, which is to create the zone in which nobody's supposed to be able to a zone that is controlled by U.S. air power, where the Syrian military is not allowed to do certain things. I don't think that there's going to be any such thing in Syria because of precisely the sentiment that you've pointed out is reflected in Martin Dempsey's statement.
Yeah, I mean, this was the Chalabi plan for Iraq back in 1996, right? Oh, yeah, we'll just invade with 5,000 guys.
That was the first time that idea was broached, I think. You're correct.
And Wolfowitz said, hey, that's brilliant. We ought to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the perfect entree into war, as people who've been proposing it know perfectly well, yeah.
Yeah, option B, the rolling start, I guess. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so listen, let's talk about this piece that you've got here in the Loeb blog. That's Jim Loeb, the Washington Bureau Chief for Interpress Service, his great blog, loebblog.com. How Rotella reported another dubious uranium bomb plot. Well, who's Rotella, and what was the first dubious uranium bomb plot?
Well,
I'm terribly concerned about
actually,
uranium bomb plots.
It's actually two or even more, depending on how you want to count them up. But the first one, of course, is the AMIA 1994 terror bombing in Buenos Aires, which he has completely bought into the Nisman report on. I mean, he completely embraces the claims that Nisman is continuing to make, that the Iranians were completely behind this. In fact, made a decision in 1993, in August of 1993, at a meeting in Mashhad, that they would blow up the AMIA Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires. And as I pointed out in my piece some weeks ago, it turns out that what Nisman is citing as the evidence for that meeting is testimony by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. This has never really been pointed out in any press coverage until I wrote that story. So that's the first one. Rotella has embraced that one.
And wait a minute, let me interrupt for just a second.
Yeah.
For people who aren't familiar, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq is a communist terrorist cult that used to work for the Ayatollah in the revolution back in 79, and then after betraying him, or getting betrayed by him, went to work for Saddam Hussein up until about 2003, where then they went to work for Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney in Iraq and Iran.
Funneling
information
more
for Mossad, the Israeli intelligence liars.
I would say even more. I think they've been primarily in the pay of Mossad for many years, since the early to mid-1990s. That the Mujahideen-e-Khalq was once both Marxist and Islamic, supposedly. And, of course, they gave up both their Marxism and their Islamism along the way to becoming essentially a bunch of terrorists for hire.
Yeah, well, and also they are a wacky Heaven's Gate style cult too, with very strict sexual rules, and you have to raise your hand for permission to speak, like kindergarten, and craziness. Yeah. Craziness.
Yeah. It's become a very strange organization with very little to say for it, except that they have a lot of money to buy off American politicians. Mm-hmm.
And even the one thing that they got right, they cribbed from David Albright, who will correctly, I think, cry and insist that he really pointed to Natanz first, and I don't know if it was the Israelis that told him about it. But right. The MEK, they never really have gotten a single thing right that they actually got first, have they?
I can't think of a single case where they've gotten it right. And, you know, there are plenty of cases one can document where they've gotten it wrong. And the IAEA let the Los Angeles Times know a few years ago. I don't remember exactly when this was published at the moment, but there was an interesting story, IAEA officials saying that the intelligence, they didn't specifically say the intelligence that was coming from the MEK, but clearly that's what they were talking about, that they had received had been consistently wrong. So I think we're very clear on that one.
Okay. So now, anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting, but people need to know that when then we get back to the so-called Hezbollah Iran bombing of the Jewish community center in Buenos Aires in 1994, those lies originated with the MEK cult. You can go ahead and put that on your dismiss it list and move on from there.
The second one that Rotella has embraced is the strange JFK airport plot of 2007-2008, which was a bunch of misfits who couldn't have blown up their grandmother's pantry. They had no real plan. They didn't know what they were doing. And it was another one of these FBI stings where, you know, nothing was really going on until an FBI informant got in touch with this poor loser, former baggage handler at JFK, and the guy started sounding off about how he'd love to blow up some tanks, fuel tanks at JFK. So Nisman has managed to tie it to Iran through this guy Kadir, and I won't go into details. We're not talking about that. But the point is that Rotella has completely embraced that tale as well from Nisman. And again, I just completely exploded that one in an IPS story a few weeks ago. So those are two that I've talked about in detail. And then, you know, I mean, he also completely bought the Israeli U.S., I think it's fair to say as well, tale about Burgas bombing being a Hezbollah operation, a story that that has never been, not just has not been proven, but there's no real evidence that has been put forward to support that.
Mm-hmm. And this is which bomb again, in Baku?
No, this is the Burgas bombing in Bulgaria last summer.
The bus bombing.
The bus bombing in Bulgaria, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, who do you think did that then?
So he's bought into the entire story of the worldwide terrorism plots by Iran and Hezbollah. And so now the new story that I've done is how he added another one. I'm adding another one to that, which is Azerbaijan. 2008, the alleged 2008 bombing plot in Azerbaijan.
Okay, wait, now hold on a second. I'm sorry. I didn't even necessarily mean to divert us here, but you didn't hear me ask the question, but so now I got to ask it again. Who did you think did the Bulgaria attack if it wasn't Iran and Hezbollah?
Well, I mean, my suspect would be al-Qaeda for the simple reason that al-Qaeda has, in fact, bombed Israeli tourist sites and more than once. I mean, they've taken responsibility for it in the past, and because Hezbollah has said, look, to get revenge against the Israelis, we don't go against Jewish or Israeli civilians. That's really an insult to us to think that we would do that. That they have something much bigger and more important in mind, and I think that's based on their past record, I think it's perfectly credible.
Right. I mean, that's the whole thing here is what we're talking about is their past record. And from the point of view of the warmongers, they got 10 examples, it sounds like, or 5 examples of all these times, this global campaign of terrorism, as you talk about. But none of it's right. It's just example after example of a bunch of MEK or MEK-level nonsense.
You know, it may be at some point along the way that the Iranians had a plan to carry out a bombing in response to the killing of Iranian scientists. I can't rule that out absolutely by any means. I wouldn't rule it out by any means. But so far, there has not been the kind of evidence that really would stand up that shows that there's no question that the Iranians have done that or that Hezbollah has carried out any bombing in as a revenge against any of these things that the Israelis say the Iranians and Hezbollah want to revenge, one of them being the killing of Imad Mughniyeh, the top-ranking security official of Hezbollah in Damascus in 2008. And that's the one where I'm quoting Nasrullah as saying, look, we want to take revenge all right, but we'll do it in our own sweet time and we'll do it right, not attacking civilians. So that's the storyline so far as I see it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now, I guess before you get to dismantling the case, what is exactly the case that they had done this bombing in Azerbaijan? And are they just making stuff up here, or is there a reason that they think what they think, Rotella and the people he's citing here?
The first point that caught my attention about this story is that nothing was said, nothing was whispered, no leaks to the media for an entire year after this supposed plot unfolded allegedly in the spring of 2008. And supposedly, again, it was supposed to be a retaliation, revenge for the killing of Imad Mughniyeh in Damascus in February of 2008. But again, nothing said for an entire year. No leaks by Israel or by Azerbaijan. No statements by Azerbaijan or Israel about this until May 30th or 31st, 2009, when Rotella publishes a story which is based clearly on Israeli sources and Matthew Levitt, who might as well be an Israeli source. I mean, he basically does nothing. He works for WINIP, of course, the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, and does nothing but pass on information that reflects the Israeli point of view on terrorism, which is his beat. So the story comes out in May 2009 that there was a plot by two Lebanese who were working for Hezbollah and the Azerbaijanis claim that they were also working for al-Qaeda, which is an interesting plot line. Which, of course, I don't believe for a moment.
Like the terrorists of the Mavi Marmara.
Exactly. So the idea was that they were going to blow up the Israeli embassy, which is in a 7-story high-rise building, which is heavily guarded and which no one is allowed to park close to, and which would have required arguably thousands of pounds of TNT to actually do what they claimed they were wanting to do. And according to the story that Rotella tells, the alleged plotters had amassed a total of a few hundred pounds of TNT, and they were waiting for more from their Iranian spies, according to the story. So that part of it didn't particularly ring true, but even...
Now, are you sure the FBI wasn't in on this? It sounds like one of theirs.
Well, it does sound like a kind of FBI plot, but no, there's no sign of an FBI.
Oh, okay. No, I'm just joking. It just sounds that ridiculous is all.
But the real giveaway that this plot line is complete fiction is that the Azerbaijani security officials added another element to the alleged bombing plot, which was that these alleged Hezbollah guys also were planning to attack a Russian radar site in northern Azerbaijan called Gabala, a site which was the Russians had already begun discussions to turn over, the possibility of turning over to the United States. But there were 900 Russian military personnel there, or not military personnel, but personnel of the Russian Space Agency, if I remember correctly. So an attack on that, of course, would have been just what the doctor ordered for the Israelis, but not exactly what the Iranians would have wanted in terms of their relations with Russia. And for what? I mean, for no reason whatsoever. So that was clearly, that's just a complete fiction, I mean, without any question. That doesn't add up at all. I mean, there are other problems as well. I mean, the storyline about how they were captured trying to flee to Iran with all of the incriminating evidence in their car, you know, all of the TNT supposedly that they had amassed was in their car, you know, trying to flee to Iran. You know, that's an insult to our intelligence, it seems to me.
Yeah. Well, that happens every so often with these. And on the big picture, too, and this is, it's an interesting thing. It's the same on all these little terrorist attacks as it is on the nuclear program. A steady stream of accusations. Some of them got to be true. There's got to be a nuclear weapons program, and there's got to be an international terror campaign here somewhere. Gareth, are you just
one
blind or what? Because I keep hearing this for decades in a row.
With all that smoke, there's got to be some fire somewhere, one would think.
Right. It's a very powerful narrative.
Yeah.
And this is your book. Your book is dismantling the lies about the Iranian nuclear program.
Yes, thank you for giving me a chance to talk about that. Any chance I get, I will take advantage of it. Yeah, my book is going to dismantle the complete tale of the covert Iranian nuclear program from the, you know, going back to the very beginning and looking at how the real hidden story of the Iranian nuclear program is how the United States, basically the Iranians were intending to do precisely what the United States and its allies now are demanding, which is to have the Europeans, specifically the French or the Russians, enrich the uranium for them and turn it into fuel rods for Bushehr. And that's what the Iranians were planning to do when they, after the Islamic Revolution, when they had to make a decision about what are we going to do about Bushehr and the nuclear program. And they were very skeptical about the whole, the Shah's nuclear program. I mean, they felt that it was a kind of toy, an expensive toy, which reflected his relationship with the United States and all that went with that. So they were very unenthusiastic about it, but they had this Bushehr reactor, which they'd put millions, you know, billions of dollars into, really, which was like 80% complete and then had been bombed during the war, and they had to decide what to do with it. Well, they finally decided they'd try to resuscitate it because they'd put so much money into it, and that meant, you know, trying to make arrangements for getting enrichment, you know, to get the fuel rods. Well, it turned out the United States wouldn't let the French cooperate with the Iranians to do that. They wouldn't even let them enrich the uranium, turn it into fuel rods for the Bushehr reactor, because that would mean that the Iranians would get some knowledge about nuclear reactors and nuclear power, and that was too dangerous. So that's really the origins of how the Iranians had to make the decision to either abandon their nuclear rights completely, which was an unacceptable choice, or essentially acquire the capabilities to enrich uranium themselves, and that's exactly what they decided to do. And that then was turned into a propaganda ploy by the United States as a basis for accusing the Iranians of wanting to have nuclear weapons, which I'm going to point out was quite useful for certain interests in the U.S. national security state. And I'm going to leave it at that. I won't go into detail, but I think the, you know, I document in my book how useful that was for the U.S. national security state to take that position.
Well, you know, if anybody out there is a capitalist, they ought to be able to recognize that the government of Iran, even a government, even an Iranian government, can think in terms of opportunity cost, and there just is no international market for uranium ore, especially not if you're Iran and the Americans, are, as you're talking about, are clamped down on every aspect of what you're doing. But there is an international market for oil, so obviously you're going to try to burn as much uranium as you can and sell the oil and make the money. It's as simple as that. There's no reason to believe that this is all just cover for one day having a nuke at all.
That's precisely right. I mean, and of course, the economists from the United States were saying precisely that when the Shah was in power. I mean, they were saying, yeah, there's a very strong case here for nuclear power. And then, you know, a couple of decades later, you know, the chorus of, there's no economic basis for this. This can only be for one thing, and that's nuclear weapons, began to be read in the op-ed pages and the news columns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then it's amazing how many Wall Street Journal readers have never even heard of opportunity cost before in this, when it comes to this issue, huh?
Yeah, but you know, one little piece of information which I think some of your listeners will find interesting is that in my research, I discovered that a very interesting source, in fact, endorsed completely the Iranian case that they had no choice but to go secret after the United States essentially refused to let them have a peaceful nuclear program and tried its best to prevent them from getting any nuclear technology of any kind, including Bushehr itself.
Oh, yeah? Who's that?
That's David Sanger of the New York Times, who in his book says, and I can't quote it word for word, but essentially he says that there's no doubt that it is true that what the Iranians say, that they had no choice but to go to the black market to get their nuclear technology and to keep it secret from the IAEA, because the United States was trying to prevent them from getting any nuclear technology.
Yeah. And even still, that's up to, what, 2003 or even before then when they declared everything?
Well, that's right, before they declared everything. I'm talking about the 1980s and 1990s, exactly.
Right. So, but just so people understand, if they're new at this, it's all been declared for better than 10 years now.
Right.
All right. Hey, listen, we got to go, but thanks very much for coming back on the show, Gareth. Great to talk to you again.
Thanks very much, Scott. Glad to be back again.
All right, see you. Everybody, that is Gareth Porter the Great. IPSnews.net to read his journalism and here to hear him talk about it. All right, we'll see you guys tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Rocky Mountain Miners at rockymountainminers.com. Ever wanted to destroy the Federal Reserve System? Now's your chance. New free market currencies are making our fake government money a thing of the past, and good riddance. If you want to mine new bitcoins and litecoins into circulation, you need a computer set up to crack the codes to the new coins. Get the prospector from rockymountainminers.com. It's ready to do the work right out of the box. Crack the equations, spend the money. Use promo code Scott Horton Show and save $100. Get all the info and get the prospector at rockymountainminers.com. Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumperstickers.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else is stuck. stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.